Exodus 21 through 20:26, Making a People, the 15th talk in a series titled The Bible's Greatest Hits, was presented by David Crabtree on February 3, 1998, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Prepared to talk about is Exodus chapter 20, and I hope that's what I was supposed to talk about. In chapter 20, Moses records the Ten Commandments. And what I'd like to talk about is, what are the Ten Commandments? As I was thinking about this passage this week, it just occurred to me that the Ten Commandments used to be in every classroom, as I remember, and displayed prominently in lots of other places as well. But I can't remember ever having reflected on what they are. What are the Ten Commandments? Why'd they show up in the Bible at all? What was God trying to do? And I guess that's the question that I want to raise tonight and see if we can make progress on that. And I guess, as always, when I teach, I see this as a work in progress. These are my thoughts to this point, but I encourage you to consider what questions you might have or comments, and we can pursue these afterwards. I would be glad to do that. That doesn't even mean that I'll have answers, but I'd be glad to entertain questions. Okay, where does this happen in Exodus? Where do these come in the historical narrative? It's about halfway through the book, a little over halfway through the book. And what is it that has set this up? Well, if you'll recall, way back in Genesis, God came to Abraham and said, I am going to make of you a great people. And Abraham had a son, but that was hardly a great people. You need more than one son to have a great people. So that was a work that God was yet to do. And the descendants of Abraham, through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, had 12 sons. And that whole clan, that's closer to a people, that whole clan ended up moving down to Egypt as a result of a famine in the promised land where they were living. End up in Egypt, and there they grew in numbers and became enslaved by the Egyptian pharaoh and lived in slavery there for about 400 years, 400 some years. Then God kind of showed up on Moses' doorstep and said, I want you to lead my people out of Egypt. So he sent Moses back to, he had met Moses in the desert, he sent Moses back to Egypt where Moses had been born, and Moses' instructions were to lead the Israelites out of Egypt and out of slavery. God accomplished that freeing of them from their slavery through a series of miracles, series of plagues, the likes of which the world had never seen and will never see. Certainly had never seen and hasn't seen again. And he was taking a bunch of people that were slaves. Most of them were descendants of Abraham, but there are indications in the text that not all of them were. These are people that the only thing they have all in common is that they were slaves. But they are not a people. They don't have the cohesion. They aren't a society. They aren't a group of people with shared history, shared traditions, shared values. And through a process of inflicting these plagues on Pharaoh and the Egyptians, God convinces Pharaoh to let the people go, and Moses leads them out of Egypt, and then leads them through the desert towards Mount Sinai. So God acted in a way that God had never acted before in history, in a very overt fashion, much more overt over a period of time than anything that we have recorded in history. Then, leading them through the wilderness, he gave them instructions. He taught them. He gave them aid, gave them guidance. There were times when they grumbled about the conditions, and God listened to the grumbling and responded to their needs and castigated them for their grumbling and brought them step by step to Mount Sinai. And so it's at the base of Mount Sinai then that this action takes place, that the Ten Commandments are given, after this process of God taking them through the wilderness. And in this process of leading them out of Egypt and to Mount Sinai, God has consistently been showing them who He is, primarily His power is one thing that He's been showing. And another thing that God has been showing to them is what He, as a God, values, what's important to Him. And He has begun to make them a people. Only a year into the desert, they already have a shared history, a very dramatic shared history. Together, they all came out of Egypt. Together, they all experienced those plagues. Together, they all experienced God's leading and guidance through the wilderness. So in a very short period of time, God has been able to forge social bonds between people. Experience, especially hardships, are very bonding. And I think backpacking has been one of those kinds of things in my life. People that I've backpacked with, there is some kind of bond that forms there. I remember soon after I got married trying to talk my wife into going backpacking, and she says, "Well, what's fun about it?" And so I started telling her all the wonderful experiences I'd had, like the time when my brother and I went backpacking, and about 8 hours into our hike, we both threw up within 5 minutes of each other. We thought that was pretty incredible. We were so sick. We were so sick we couldn't hike out, so we just kind of parked there and figured, well, I hope we get well before we need to eat anymore or do anything else. So there was that experience. There was this other experience when we went on a 70-mile hike, and everybody had some kind of ailment. One guy had wrecked his knee, and I had so many blisters on my feet I couldn't wear my boots anymore. And at one lunchtime, we all just flopped down on the ground, and we heard this blood-curdling screech. And all we could think that it possibly could be is some other hiker that was lying down on the trail and somebody else stepped on their feet. But I go through all the most memorable things that happened to me backpacking, and they're all bad. And she says, "Why go?" But there's something bonding about hardship. Same thing happens in marriage. There's something bonding about hardship. There's the first kid. There's the second kid. There's something really bonding about hardship. So God had been able to compress a lot of experience into a short period of time, and in a very short period of time had begun the process of making a people. Shared history. His goal for his people is expressed in Genesis 19, or Exodus 19. Just before he gives the Ten Commandments, God says what he's about. Verse 3 of chapter 19. And Moses went up to God. And the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you to myself. Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel." Now, until I had looked at Exodus just a few months ago, I'd never noticed this verse in particular. Verse 6 is what I have in mind. "And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests." Apparently, what God has in mind is making Israel into a people that will serve the same function with respect to the rest of the world that the priesthood in Israel served with respect to the rest of the Israelites. And that function is, on the one hand, is essentially to be the mediator, the go-between. That the priest is the one who relays the concerns and interests of the people to God, communicates them to God, and the one through whom God communicates his requests, his instructions for the people. So the priest is that mediator, that go-between. And his goal for Israel is that it would become a nation of priests, that it would serve that same function of going before God with the concerns of mankind as a whole, and would go to mankind speaking for God. So God wants to create out of the Israelites a people, but not just any people, a special people, a people that's going to serve a very important purpose. So the law then is given to them, and it apparently is in outline form what God is going to go on and expound upon later in Exodus. So this is just the outline form of what God requires of the Israelites. This is going to be the founding document. This is going to be the principles on which they will be one people, and the principles on which they will operate and live. The law was presented, the law as a whole, not just the Ten Commandments, but the law as a whole was presented at Mount Sinai in three different parts. The first is the Ten Commandments that are given in chapter 20. And apparently, God himself spoke these commandments to the people. That's the way it seems to read. Then Moses went up on the mountain and received the second installment of the law as a whole. And that, for the most part, is made up of clarification and amplification on some of the principles that are laid down in the Ten Commandments. It is, for the most part, moral law. Then Moses goes back up on the mountain and receives the third installment. And the third installment is the ceremonial law, the festivals that are set up, the design of the tabernacle, the Ark of the Covenant, etc. So the Ten Commandments then is just the very first installment. And it seems to be the bare outline of what will later be filled out as the rest of the law is given. The law is organized in, well, let's just look at some details of how the law is organized, and then I'll make a generalization. Let me read verses 1 through 17 of chapter 20. "Then God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your cattle or your sojourner who stays with you. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Now there are a few features of this that I want to point out. First of all, it's possible that what we have here is a list of commandments, a list of principles in random order. It could be that there's no method to the madness here. It's just, here's one, and oh, here's another one, and oh, here's another one, here's another one. I think that's unlikely. I think there's probably some kind of organization. There's some reason why they come in the order that they're in, and that if we can recover what that organization is, it will help us to understand the whole, what's going on here. Now, a couple of things of note. One is, in the first five commandments through the Sabbath, we do have a certain amount of elaboration given as to why these things should be done. Not with all of them, but there is some elaboration on each one of them if we lump two of them together. In the last five, there's no elaboration. They're very short. It's just, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. The second observation is one that I have to take on the basis of other authority because my Hebrew is too rusty to be able to discern this. But the last five, according to Umberto Casuto, who is always right, the last five are all grammatically linked and build on themselves. So it's all a chain. Okay, if we look at it that way, it would appear as though there's some kind of break halfway through them. What is the nature of that break? Well, the first five seem to be talking about the relationship between man and God. And the second five seem to be dealing with the relationship between man and man inside a society. Now, that's tentative. Store that away because I'm going to rely upon that as I talk about these. I'm going to assume that that is indeed the organization. That the first five are talking about the relationship between God and man, and the second five are talking about the relationship between man and man. However, the fifth one, I'm going to argue, is kind of both. It's a transition. just a curious point of interest that may or may not be significant, is in Exodus 31:18. It says, and when he had finished speaking with him upon Mount Sinai, he gave Moses the two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone, written by the finger of God. And it has been suggested that this refers to the Ten Commandments. If that's true, it's curious that it's on two tablets. That maybe there are two halves to the Ten Commandments. Maybe there is really a division here that needs to be paid attention to in the organization. God prefaces then the Ten Commandments by saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Why would he preface it this way? Why does he mention this? Well, the first thing that is a possibility is he could be saying, justice demands it. I did this for you. You owe this to me. I brought you out of Egypt. You owe obedience to me. That's a possibility. Another possibility, it seems to me, is appealing to a sense of gratitude. I did this for you. Should you not do this for me? So it's not the same kind of obligation, but rather out of gratitude. Maybe that's the appeal. There's a third option that occurs to me, and the one that seems most attractive to me. And that is, it's neither a sense of obedience or duty or a sense of gratitude, but rather, look at the history. Look what I did for you. I brought you out of Egypt. Look at all of the care and provision that I have made for you. If there's one thing that you should be able to conclude from that, it's that I have your best interests in mind. It's that I truly love you. And on that basis, then, this is what I say you should do. This is the way you should live. This is what your life should look like. And it seems to me, without any other commentary, that makes the most sense, that there's that kind of appeal. Just look at your history. I'm the one who did all of that. Okay, having made that preface then, he begins listing the Ten Commandments. The first one, you shall have no other gods before me. Now, other gods is a term that's used frequently in the Old Testament, referred to foreign gods. It has the connotation of false gods, other things that might attract your worship and obedience. And then the expression that's translated before me, that's a hotly debated preposition, as are lots of prepositions, hotly debated. But most naturally, most frequently, this would be in my presence. And I think that the idea here is that what God is requiring of them is a unique kind of relationship. The Romans, when they thought about religious matters and the divinities, they thought of the gods in terms and their relationship to God along the analogy of a friendship. How many friends can you have? You can have lots of friends. And to add another friend to your pantheon of friends does not take away from, detract from the other friendships necessarily. So the way they saw their relationship to God, it was not an exclusive kind of thing. You could add on more all you wanted, and it was not offensive to the gods. God here seems to be suggesting a different analogy for understanding the relationship that we have with him. And it is an exclusive kind of relationship, not on the analogy of friendship, but on the analogy of marriage. And on that analogy, there's only one person that you set aside to be your special partner, a partner that enjoys a kind of intimacy, a kind of oneness with you that no one else does. And God is saying, that is the analogy. That's the kind of relationship that I'm insisting upon. I'm insisting that you see me as the one God, the God who is the master of all, above whom and equal to whom there are no others. And that necessarily has to be exclusive in nature. So the first commandment, I think, is saying God alone is worthy of our worship. And that cannot be diluted. The second one, you shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness. It goes on to say, not just idol or likeness, but idol or likeness of what is in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the water under the earth. Now, is there some significance to saying no likeness of these things? He could have stopped with no idol or no likeness. In other words, prohibiting idol worship. But he goes on and says, in the likeness of anything in these places. Is there a significance to that? Well, it could be that it's simply, that's what idols were made to copy. But in that time and culture, that's the form that idols came in, and so he just threw that on it. But it occurs to me that there's another possibility, and that is that what God is afraid of is man's confusion of creator and creature. That man has a propensity to worship and give his allegiance to created things, whether it's things in the world that creatures, or whether it's something of our own creation. But the problem is a proclivity on our part to want to take a created thing and elevate it to the position of creator of God. If that's the case, then what God is insisting upon is that we keep it clear that God is not a part of creation. God is a transcendent being, the one who created this. He is not subject to the cosmos or its forces. Quite the contrary, it is subject to him. And I think that our tendency to want to demote God from transcendent creator to something created is a part of a flaw that's built into us, and that is inverting the master-servant relationship. That we would love to be not the servant, but rather the master. And that's, it seems to me, is a proclivity that was first manifest in Genesis chapter 3. If that's true then, if God is the transcendent creator, then all that happens, happens on his terms rather than ours. God is boss, God is the master. He reveals when he wants and as he wants, not to our whim. God is sovereign. So I think that the second commandment then could be restated. God is transcendent creators. We are dependent creatures. Don't confuse those two. Then in verse 5 and 6, he says, you shall not worship them or serve them. For, so now he's going to give his explanation why those two commandments ought to be followed. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. Where he says, I am a jealous, I think that this explanation applies to the first two commandments, that they're being lumped together. And now he's giving a justification for both of those two commandments. And that his justification is, I'm a jealous God. There, I think it's that idea, the relationship that I require of you with me is an exclusive one. It is on the analogy of marriage rather than friendship. But then he goes on to say that he visits the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. I mentioned this when I taught in this passage at Reformation Fellowship a few months ago. I mentioned what I'm going to mention now. When I read this, the third and fourth generations, it really struck me because I had a talk with a cowboy from Eastern Oregon, in which he talked about third and fourth generations. And it seemed very relevant to this particular passage. And eventually I will make the relevance known. I was traveling with him, and he was just telling me about ranching in Eastern Oregon. And he lives on a ranch that's been in his family for several generations. And he was mentioning that the trend in Eastern Oregon, the part of Eastern Oregon where he lives, is for the young people that are born into farming families, the young people are leaving the farms and they're going to the cities. They don't want to live as ranchers. They want an easier life and one that brings more comforts than ranching provides. So most of them are leaving. And people are buying those ranches that have never been ranchers. Usually they're retiring doctors and lawyers and that sort of thing. And they're buying up that land, and his complaint is they don't know what to do with that land. They don't really know how to use it. They don't know how to run it. And in his mind, they're doing damage to that land, and that's a shame. And he said that what he's noticed is, and the thing that's really a shame about that, is those children who were raised on the ranch and are going to the city, that knowledge that they had gained is lost. And he said the real shame is it takes three or four generations to rebuild that knowledge. I thought, three or four generations, that doesn't make any sense. But how can that be that it takes three or four generations to accumulate the kind of knowledge that he's talking about? But he said everybody who learns ranching, when they're growing up in the ranch family, they just tag along with their father. And they see their father do everything that he does. And their father will say, well, I'm doing this because of this. If he's a talkative rancher, if he's not a talkative rancher, he just does it. and the son has to figure out why. But he said, that's the process that you go through to learn how to ranch. And he says, it's very complicated. He said, it takes a lot of time and a lot of experience to know what is a good cow and what's not a good cow, be able to pick them out. It takes a lot of experience and knowledge to learn a piece of ground and to learn where you can grow what and where you can't grow things and where you can find signs of trouble in your pasture and what those signs mean and what you can do to correct it. And he went on and on, all the things that go into ranching. It's a very complicated thing. He says you can't learn it in one lifetime. So what you have to do is you take one person's life experience, and over a period of many years, they teach that lifetime experience to their son. And then that son will do the same thing with his son. And he says it takes three or four generations to learn how to raise cows. I never thought of it that way, but it made a lot of sense to me. If that's true with respect to cows, what would be true with respect to learning how to love God? With respect to learning how to live wisely, live in a way that respects and acknowledges who God is. If that's true, if it takes generations to do that, then you can see how the kind of caution that he's giving here could be something other than God zapping the next three kids, the next three generations born, something that really naturally results from losing track of, not acknowledging who God is. If one generation ceases to do that, kids have lost it. The kids don't have that base of knowledge, that wisdom built into them through their upbringing. And it will take 3 or 4 generations to recover that. So I'm inclined to think that that's what it's talking about, that there is a very natural consequence that comes from losing track of who God is. And it's going to take, in the best of cases, it will take time to recover that fully. It will take several generations. But, he goes on to say, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. There's the other side of it, and that is, God is a very gracious and loving God. And the legacy that is passed down from people who love God is a very long one. It's long lasting. That a lot of capital, moral and spiritual capital, can be accumulated that will serve a society for a long time. And I would claim that our culture is an example of that. American culture, it seems to me, for the most part, has forgotten who God is. And that happened some time ago. How do we still have order in the society? How can that be? How can it be that people are, for the most part, respectful of one another? That for the most part we're able to get along and proceed and work together in our society? It's because we're living on capital that was built up. We're using it. We're depleting that capital. But that is a gracious thing that God has done, is to produce that accumulation of capital. And we should be thankful for that legacy. Okay. The third commandment then. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. Usually in commentaries this is taken to mean don't swear falsely. Don't say, by God, I'm going to do such and such and then not do it. And that may be what it's talking about. But if I'm right in the organization of these commandments, the first five are with respect to man's relationship to God. And I'm inclined to take this a little bit differently. I'm not inclined to think that it just means don't swear falsely. If we were to translate this more woodenly, what it means, the way it would be translated is, you shall not take the name the Lord your God for nothing, to be worthless. And I'm convinced in Hebrew, when we say name, we're talking about not just the sounds that we associate with something, but we're talking about something much more significant than that. If you look at the way name is used, certainly in Genesis, but from what I've observed in the Old Testament in general, when you name something in Hebrew culture, you are trying to figure out what at the very essence of this thing, what is distinctive about it. How can I, in capsule form, express what this thing is right down at its root? And so name becomes almost the thing itself, the identity of that thing. So if we read this with that in mind, it seems to me that it says something more like, do not take God lightly. God is not a peripheral part of your life. God is not an add-on. But if you understand who God is and who you are, God is really right at the heart of it, right at the center of it, around which everything else is peripheral. So I think that that's what that the heart of this commandment is, that remember who God is and what place, what role he ought to play in your life. That is right at the heart of it. Then he cautions, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. if you take God lightly, there is a punishment that's attached to that, that is necessarily attached to that. And God will take you lightly, in a sense. The fourth commandment then, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work. Now why is this here? This really seems out of place. It's the only one that appears to be ceremonial or a religious practice. Why would this be in here with the other 9 commandments? It seems like it doesn't fit. Now here again, I'm going to come back to my assumption about the organization. If my understanding of the organization is true, that the first 5 are dealing with our relationship to God, then this one must in some way be dealing with that. And how could this be dealing with that? He refers back to the creation and the fact that God worked for 6 days creating the universe, and then on the seventh, and as I explained when I taught on Genesis 1, I think that the creation narrative, including day 7, is in capsule form the history of the universe. And that God, there was creative activity that took place for those 6 days. Then, when everything was finished, all of that creative activity was finished, God rested. He was done with the task that he had set out to do. And that man then is going to, in a sense, do the same thing. Man too has a task to do. He was put on earth to work the garden. That's why Adam was placed in the garden. So he has a task to do that was given to him. But his task is a finite one. Just as God's task lasted for 6 days and then it ended, man's task on earth is a finite one that will come to an end. And when it comes to an end, man will enter into his rest. And that last day is a day that Moses does not indicate that it has a beginning and end. The other days each have a beginning and end. The seventh day does not. So a task that is ended with cessation from that task, when the task is completed. I think then what this commandment is pointing to is it's saying, remember what God did when he created the world, when he created the universe. That is the story. That is the history of the universe. And you as a human being are in that history of the universe. You too are here for a task. But it is a finite task, and when it's done, you will enter into the rest. Every week, I want you to remember that. Every week, there is a day out of the week which is going to remind you that the rest is coming. That what you're doing here is a finite thing, and it will end. And don't confuse the two. Don't fall for the illusion that this is where it is. Don't sink your roots down here. Don't invest yourself here. Because this comes to an end. So what I think then this commandment is pointing out is through an act, through this reserving one day aside, it is a weekly reminder of the fact that this is not all there is. Don't invest yourself here. Our ultimate purpose or destiny is elsewhere. So don't confuse the passing things of this world with the things of the Spirit, which are enduring. The fifth one, honor your father and mother. It says, honor your father and mother that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you. I think what he is asking here, is that this commandment, it seems to me, is a transition from the first group of commandments which deal with man's relationship to God. And then we go to the other tablets where it's man's relationship to man. This one is kind of halfway in between. It is both man's relationship to God and man's relationship to man. And here's how I think that that's the case. Respect for parental authority is something that God requires of us. It is a place in which God has invested authority in human beings, authority over other human beings. And God expects us to acknowledge that authority. When a child is born, that child is clearly dependent upon the parents. That child could not survive without the parents' help. So right from the beginning, a child intuitively understands their need for the parent, and there is built into that, I think, a sense of authority that needs to be granted to the one who is making my existence possible. There's something about the whole process that seems to instill that notion that children ought to be subservient to their parents, be respectful of their parents. What's interesting about that is, how does a parent get that authority? By having kids. And as a child, you say, why should I obey those two people? Why should I be respectful and honor those two people? The answer is, because God gave you to them. So respect for parents means respect for God and the order that he has established in this universe. The two are very closely linked together. And I think that this same concept carries over into other things, that respect for parents is the most obvious way in which we can recognize God-given authority. But there are others. And I think that we are required to be respectful of those other authorities for the same reason. Government, for instance. Bosses. There are all kinds of authorities in our lives, teachers. There are authorities established in our lives. And we are to respect those. We are to acknowledge wherever there is God-granted authority and respect that authority. Why? Because God put them there. It's a recognition of how God has ordered the world and the authorities that he has placed in the positions where he's placed. I've probably mentioned this before. I don't know if I've mentioned it to you people, but it has become increasingly clear to me that ultimately, as human beings, authority is granted. We can always be rebels. We can always challenge authority, and if we do, if enough of us challenge it, there's a sense in which we can bring it down. The only thing that keeps that in place, at least from a human perspective, is our acknowledging its existence. If we cease to acknowledge it, then there ceases to be authority, and chaos is a result. So I think that this, it says honor your father and mother, but it has other implications. In other words, be respectful of God-given authority. And what it says following that is that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you. It's a very interesting thing to conclude this with. What would be the connection between respect for honoring your father and your mother and the days being long in the land which the Lord your God gives you? I read this summer, I was reading The History of Civilizations by François Braudel, a French historian. I haven't finished the book, but I hope to someday. But in the book he says, no major civilization has ever fallen as a result of conquest. No major empire has fallen because of conquest. It's always because that civilization or empire loses the will to exist. It forgets why it exists. It loses any purpose, and it implodes. It becomes so weakened that then it's easy prey for other, for enemy countries. I think that's true. My understanding of history is that that's typically what you see. Rome wasn't defeated, Rome collapsed. Greek civilization wasn't defeated, it collapsed. And at the heart of it is a moral collapse. So how do you prolong your days in the land? How do you stay a coherent society that's able to withstand outward attacks from the outside? You remain a moral and cohesive society. And respect for authority is right at the heart of that. Okay. So there again, it is to a large extent, this commandment to respect your father and mother, if I'm understanding it correctly, is largely dealing with our relationship to God, but also to a certain extent our relation to other human beings, that is, respect for authority. Then, in the last five commandments, it talks about how people ought to relate to one another, what kinds of guidelines there need, or principles there need to be. These are all, as I've mentioned before, very terse. No reasons or justifications are given for any of these. So presumably, these are all principles that have been long known. These aren't new things for the most part. God just lists them. Don't murder, that is, don't take the life of another human being. Do not commit adultery. This used to be fairly clear. Certain people have confused the issue of what is adultery in recent days. But do not commit adultery. Do not steal. Do not bear false witness. In other words, don't lie, don't distort the truth. And I think at the heart of that is doing harm to one another as a result of that distortion of truth. So those are all, I don't think I will comment on any of those. The only one I want yet to comment on is the last one. And this one would have been different from the other law codes of societies of that time. The last one, verse 17, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his manservant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. So in the previous four commandments, God has said, don't take somebody's life, don't take somebody's wife, and don't take someone's possessions, and don't take someone's good name. And then in this last one, he says, don't even covet those things. Up until then, they're all pretty doable. And they're all pretty standard for the law codes of that time. What's different here is, don't even consider that a good thing. Our perspective is to be not only keep your hands off of someone else's possessions, but to put things into perspective and to realize God gave that to him, not me. And to respect the way that God has allocated the resources that he's allocated. Respect the way that God has distributed things and say, it's good. If God did it that way, it's fine for me. That's good. Very quickly then in conclusion, I think that there is other support elsewhere for the kind of organization that I am claiming to be here. And I think that the words of Jesus himself are supportive of it. Let me read Matthew 22:34-40. 22:34-40. This is the Pharisees come to Jesus and they're wanting to ask him some pointed questions with respect to the law. They say, but when the, it says, but when the Pharisees heard that he had put the Sadducees to silence, they gathered themselves together. And one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him. Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? And he said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and foremost commandment. So I think what God, what Jesus has done here is taken the first five commandments and boiled it down to one statement. Then he goes on to say, and a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets. So here he's taken the second five and condensed them, summarized them in one statement. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. So I take this as evidence that Jesus saw the same kind of organization that I'm describing here. And because he saw the same organization, was able to summarize it using these two statements in this order. Okay. There's just a couple things that I want to say in summary about this, the Ten Commandments as a whole. The first of all, and I think this is really significant, and I guess it strikes me as significant because in Gutenberg we're talking about, we've been reading some readings in which thinkers of the Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment period were trying to figure out what is the right form of government and on what basis do we form laws and what should those laws be. And all of them do this thought experiment where they go back in time and try to figure out how did society first come to be. And the first two human beings came together and decided to elect one of them as president. And they do all this thought experiment trying to figure out how it all happened. And what's striking here is that's not the approach that Moses is taking. Here, the way it's depicted is God said, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So what's happening here is law, the principles on which we ought to order our lives, the principles by which we ought to live, they are revealed to us by God. It's very difficult, as you can tell from reading the readings that we're reading, to figure out how do you anticipate when certain kinds of activities are going to be so negative to society that they can't be allowed. There's a lot of debate over that. How do you determine that sort of thing? But Moses has freed the Israelites of that kind of burden and foresight by saying, this is what God says. God says these activities are disastrous. Don't do them. The other thing that is curious about this is, as I was reading through the Ten Commandments, I was thinking, you know, you can bring two different attitudes towards them. You can come saying, I'm going to look at these and see what modifications these commandments might dictate for my life. That's one frame of mind that you can come to these with. The other frame of mind you can come to these with is, if God were to describe how a life ought to be lived, what would he say? And I think those are very different attitudes, and it makes a huge difference in how you receive them. It's kind of like in a course at the university, having two different attitudes towards the course. One would be, what's going to be on the test? And the second one being, what can I learn from this class? What does this class have to offer? What benefit can I derive from it? That there is in that first attitude already a kind of, what's the minimum? What's God, what adjustments do I have to make in my life to make myself acceptable to God? As opposed to the question, what does God want me to be like? What is God's design for mankind, perfect design and And how, what does he want of me? What does he require of me? How can I conform myself to that, to those standards? So the Ten Commandments then, I think, are supposed to be a picture of what God wants human beings to be like. In a very cursory outline, there's a lot more to be spelled out. But if we boil it down to just 10 principles, this is what it's to be like. And these are the principles that the Israelites are to use as their model as they live their lives in society, as a group, as a community. The principles that they will live by and encourage one another to live by. They will become the values of that society itself. And when they become the values of the society itself, then they will be fit to serve as a nation of priests to the rest of the world. Okay, I went over. I'm done. You're free to go. And whoever wants to stay for questions, we'll have questions in just a minute. Yes, Ellis?
Would you care to comment on Galatians 3:24?
Therefore, the law has become our tutor to lead us to Christ, that we may be justified by faith. I don't remember the context here. I'd have to look at it, but I would assume that the idea that it's referring to is an idea that shows up elsewhere in the New Testament, and that is that the law as a description of what we ought to be ends up being a very condemning picture. Because as we try to conform to that, we find ourselves failing miserably, time after time after time, no matter what we do, no matter how we maneuver, no matter how we hold our mouth. We can't seem to pull it off. And as a result, the effect of the law to someone who really wants to be what God intended them to be is to drive them down on their knees before God and say, God, help me. That it has become apparent that I cannot conform myself. It is not within me. I'm not capable of being that kind of person. And I have no recourse but to call upon your mercy as the way that that will be accomplished. So the law has the effect of driving us to faith. Denise?
My understanding of the history of the Israelites in the wilderness is pretty sketchy, but my understanding is they were driven into the wilderness twice. They went through the first time and came to Mount Sinai. How long did it take them to get there? Did you say
to Mount Sinai?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's a matter of a few months.
Just a few months.
Mm-hmm. I can't remember, 6 or 8 months.
Okay, so from the time that they saw all the miracles and they went through the wilderness initially to Mount Sinai, let's say 6 months.
Right.
Okay. Then what happens, because then God forces them back into the wilderness for 40 more years,
right,
and kills them all off.
Right.
So what, and then there was the other mountain, right? The other mountain? Wait, I'm confused, because the first mountain was when the golden calf, they did the golden calf thing.
That's here.
Oh, that is here.
Mm-hmm.
So, when he comes down from the mountain is when they build the calf? The golden calf?
They built it while he was up on the mountain, right?
Yeah, that's this time?
After God proclaimed the Ten Commandments to the people of Israel, then Moses went up on the mountaintop and was gone for 40 days receiving that second installment of the law from God.
But that's all this time.
Pardon?
That's all this time. Because Moses talks to them several times. And I get confused.
That's all at this campsite.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So first God talks to him, then law.
Right.
And then Moses splits for 40 days.
Right.
And when he comes back,
they've decided that he's died and gone to heaven. They're in real trouble, and they see no option but to make the idol.
And so then is that why the next 40 years in the wilderness?
No. Wow. No.
They make their way then from Mount Sinai to the southern entrance of the Promised Land. And he says, go in. And they send the spies in. The spies come back and they say, uh-uh, we can't do it. And so the people say, we aren't going. And God says, well, then a curse on you. I can't remember exactly what God says. But the people say, oh, we're sorry, we will go. And God says, no, don't go. And they say, no, we will go. And they charge in and are slaughtered. And they say, oops, and come back out. And so God says, well, then think about it for 40 years. Right.
So that's why they go into the wilderness for 40 years.
Right.
Thank you. Because I get confused whether the 40 years was before Mount Sinai.
Mount Sinai is literally months. It's just a few months after they have left Egypt. And that is amazing, because all of this stuff is very fresh in their memories.
Well, not only that, but the thing that always escaped my notice is that that's kind of a firework show in its own right.
Sinai.
Yes, there's
thunder booming and light, fire on the mountain. And
he says, don't touch the mountain,
right?
Right. The thing must be glowing hot or something like that.
Right. Yeah, we've got a whole six-month period is really unique in history, and the Bible keeps referring back to it, that time when God acted really overtly in history. Typically, God is behind the scenes. He's not so obvious. But at that particular time, when he was first forming the nation, in making them into a people, he chose to act very overtly.
Right, he's got the pillar of fire
and the cloud that's proceeding in front of them. They've got the manna coming down. They've got the quail flopping in front of them. It's just, they got water coming out of rocks. It's just, it's incredible. I mean, but that didn't, that's true afterwards too. But God speaks to him himself.
Less than a month later, they go back to some other god.
I think they thought they were building it to Yahweh.
If you were to, maybe I missed it, but if you were to briefly encapsulate the main significance of the Ten Commandments and why it is that God gives it to his people, or as a means of making his people at this point in history, what would it be? I mean, you seem to be saying that it was something to present us a picture of what kind of things God values, or what kind of people we ought to be. And I'm wondering, is that all the significance that there is for the Ten Commandments? Or is there...
Yeah, I don't know. God's project, as described in Exodus, is to make for himself a people. And what does it take to make a group of individuals a people? And what it requires is, it seems to me, as you look at societies and what distinguishes them from a bunch of individuals, is a lot of stuff that is shared. And that means a shared culture, shared traditions, shared history. But probably as important as anything else is a shared set of values, a shared set of beliefs as to what is valuable and what is not valuable. I guess That's not intuitively obvious that that would be necessary. I don't know, maybe to some people it's intuitively obvious, but it doesn't seem intuitively obvious to me. But if you look at various episodes in history, I think you see that those shared values are really important. You take Lot in Sodom and Gomorrah, for instance. Apparently he was really quiet about his beliefs, became a city leader, and yet he was a source of irritation to the other people in Sodom and Gomorrah. Why? Well, because he didn't share the values. There's something really irritating about people in a community that do not share basic values together. There's something divisive. There's something irritating about that. And so I think what God is doing here is establishing what those values will be, the core values around which the society will be built and will develop. And it happens to be a picture of righteousness.
So then it's kind of multi-purposed then of an event, in the sense that, one, it's giving them a picture of what kind of people they ought to be, and two, it is an experience that is being used to unify them somehow, or to make them...
Well, the Ten Commandments specifically, I think, is that set of values that this community, this society will be built around, a society that they will share in common.
Historically speaking, they made it into law, right? Isn't that what... I mean, this is what's frequently called the law, or... Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Is that significant in any way, their approach to that, historically speaking, or
is that significant?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Yeah, maybe it's somewhere else, but I thought that at some point in time there was some kind of promise made for the keeping of the law, and that it was referring to the Ten Commandments. Maybe I'm making that up. I thought that was somewhere. And I was wondering if that, even though that may not have been the main purpose or reason for God giving the law, that might have been a secondary significant purpose or something. Because, I don't know, it just seems like there's an awful lot of, like you were pointing out, there's an awful lot of show going on at Sinai with regard to, you know, the mountain and the lightning and whatnot. For to just be giving a picture of what kind of person we ought to be. I don't know, it just seems like that, I mean, did God enter into our reality, enter into history and do something significant like that, it seemed to encapsulate some kind of historical import that was going to be of importance later too.
Well, in the whole Exodus story is, I think, rather pivotal and significant for all of the history of mankind. The fact that God chose a people and made them into his special possession and used them as a vehicle by which to reveal a great deal about himself and about reality. That's a major event in the history of mankind. So there's a lot going on in Exodus, I would say, and the significances are manifold. But even apart from that, revealing what God requires of us, a picture of righteousness, I'd say that is I would list that fairly high on my scale of important things in history. So it doesn't seem inconsistent to me that there would be a lot of lights and trumpets and stuff that would go along with a lot of fanfare that would go along with that.
significant to just humanity in general. I was wondering about just specifically maybe the Israelite nation, if there was any other significance for them. I guess, I don't know, maybe I'm getting it confused with the Mosaic Covenant. That might be my mistake. Is it separate from the Mosaic Covenant, or is the Ten Commandments the same, or is the Mosaic Covenant just an addition to them, or?
I don't know. Do you know, Jack?
No, this is the heart of the Mosaic Covenant. Yeah. That you were talking about this made into the law. What's been striking to me is I've only been able to find one place in the whole Bible that mentions the Ten Commandments in the way that we do. We are the ones that have exalted the Ten Commandments into this sort of pride of place and special place. But it looks like the Jews throughout all their time took the law in its entirety, and the Ten Commandments were no particularly, you know, they were more like the table of contents, the preface to the rest of it, but they weren't somehow special.
They didn't have to do anything with those, and they were under a lot of stress to do all the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so that probably is more real.
So what's the rest of the law then? What was the rest of the... I mean, you said this is the heart of the law.
Well, like David says, I think it really does serve as a kind of outline, but the rest of the law is sort of...
It's amplification and elaboration
of what's already contained in the Ten Commandments.
Mm-hmm. Thou shalt not murder.
What does that mean? Well, the law goes into a great deal of detail as to what constitutes murder. Under what conditions is someone who commits murder to be put to death, and what conditions are they not to be put to death? And so the law goes on to elaborate on the basic points that are laid out in the Ten Commandments.
Was the law then created specifically for the Israelites, whereas you think the Ten Commandments is something that was given pretty much to all of mankind, something that significant for everyone and not just the nation of Israel?
The Ten Commandments, I think, is a picture of righteousness that is universally applicable. There are things in the law, as God goes on to lay it out, that I think are peculiar to the Israelite people. And it helps me to think in terms of the Levitical priesthood with vis-a-vis the Israelite nation. If the nation of Israel is to be a nation of priests to the rest of the world, then it would be analogous to the Levites with respect to the rest of Israel. And we have a special laws, special regulations, different things that single the Levites out, things that they are supposed to do that the rest of the Israelites don't need to do. By analogy, then, I think the same is true of the law. The law not only spells out in more detail what the Ten Commandments mean and how they would be worked out and applied, but it goes on to talk about the special regulations that are true of the nation of Israel, which set them apart and make them the special nation of priests that God intends them to be.
This is controversial, but you see that in the Ten Commandments themselves, I think, because the commandment to keep the Sabbath is peculiar to the Jewish people, to the Jewish nation. The rationale for keeping the Sabbath and what that represents is universal. But he's not saying believe what you would believe if you did keep the command, if you did keep the Sabbath. He's commanding them to keep the Sabbath, I think.
Hmm.
And that's a peculiar covenant that he's making with them.
Yeah, I have a question regarding that particular thing. We as New Testament believers in Christ seem to embrace all of those except, all of the main commandments except for that. I'm curious about that. Is a Sabbath okay, or does it have to be the Sabbath? I mean, are we, as you know, New Testament believers, should we set aside one day? Mm-hmm. Can it be just Tuesday or Thursday, or
you split it up? That was a little bit what was kind of behind my question as well. Is I was trying to understand what does it mean, this idea to be under the law. I mean, they were commanded to do this, and yet we're not. It doesn't seem like we are. I mean,
yeah, there's no flexibility for them.
Right.
He tells them it's every week, and he tells them how to do it.
On pain and death.
Yeah.
I still don't even know this.
You might not agree with me, but my view is that the way you and I as New Testament believers keep the Sabbath is recognize what God was intending to communicate, teach, do through this ritual of Sabbath keeping. Namely, I like what you said. I think that makes a lot of sense. And believe that every day of the week.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we keep the Sabbath, I think, is recognize. The way you were interpreting it, which makes sense, is an anti-worldliness commandment. Don't be worldly.
Mm-hmm.
And we should not be worldly every day of the week, and that's how we keep the Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.